News Talk Sunday.
We've lots of developments throughout the day. There's a lot of overlapping themes here and everyone asking what comes next, even on the streets of Iran. Overnight, we had a confirmation from a number of sources, even from the state media in Iran, that Ayatollah Al-Khamenei, who's been really the supreme leader for many, many years in that country, is dead, and nobody really knows what kind of power vacuum is now going to build up. Meanwhile, strikes and also drone activity in a number of Middle Eastern countries continues. Dubai is one of those places that has been affected by some of what's happening. It's very hard to get a full picture of what's going on the ground. Some people saying it's quite a terrifying situation for people who certainly can't fly out of there because there is air restrictions. But shortly before we come on air, I talked to Gino Forte from Clonmel, who's a businessman based in Dubai, and he's been telling me what he sees.
The way things feel and the way things look online are very different. So the way things feel here is it feels like things are under control. I think there was over 200 missiles intercepted successfully last night. But the difference is the missiles aren't being shot here at us. They're being intercepted as they come over us. Unfortunately, we're neighbors of Iran, and Iran are shooting over us, aiming for wherever they're trying to go, and we're being intercepted here by the US base, I believe, in Dubai. What's happening is debris is falling from these missiles, is what it looks like. One of them has unfortunately landed in the car park beside the Fairmont Hotel on the Palm, which was quite unfortunate. I actually had a client of mine staying there. They were evacuated, but that was put out. No one was hurt. There was another bit of debris landed in a park. No one was hurt there. And a bit of debris landed near the airport where there was, I think, three injuries. We've had no confirmed deaths in Dubai. I think one confirmed death in Abu Dhabi, if I'm not mistaken.
Now, that is the latest on the ground in Dubai from Gino Forte. He's an Irish businessman based there. We will have later on in our show a full update on what's happening with travel in the region. A lot of flights cancelled, hard to get in or out of various capitals throughout the Middle East. We will have a roundup of what's happening there. And of course, what happens next? What is this gamble by Donald Trump? And where might it take us? We'll be talking to Paul Brandes later on. But before we do any of that, let's get straight to the Middle East. We have Greg Karlstrom, who is the Middle East correspondent with The Economist, I believe based in Riyadh. And we also have Scott Lucas, who is a professor of US and international politics at UCD. Greg, if I can go to you first. There's a slight delay on the line here, but Greg, what are you hearing in terms of the reaction throughout the region to the confirmation now that Ayatollah Al-Khamenei has been killed?
There are a lot of people in the region in Arab countries who will be celebrating the news, who will be happy about the news. This is someone who oversaw an Iranian foreign policy for decades that sponsored militias in various countries across the Middle East that propped up the Assad regime in Syria. It is a regime that is deeply unloved by many people across the region. But I think mixed with that, there's concern about what's going to come next, about how Iran might retaliate for Khamenei's death, how it might retaliate particularly against countries in the Gulf. And then a question of who's going to replace him and what Iran looks like going forward. Is it a more hardline figure who takes power? Does the country tip into chaos like we saw in Iraq after the Americans invaded in 2003? There's just a great deal of uncertainty about what comes next.
And a lot of people speculating that normally a group of experts, as they're called, come together to elect a supreme leader, but just physically and logistically even to do that under bombardment from Israeli and US jets, it's hard to think that they can actually physically come together to make that decision.
Right. There is a process that's spelled out in the Iranian constitution. There's only been one transition before when Khamenei took power. He's been in power since the late 1980s. But there is a formal process for doing this. The problem, as you say, is going to be implementing it. When Khamenei was killed, it seems he was at a meeting at his compound in Tehran with a number of other top Iranian officials. Sort of inexplicable that they would all gather in the same place with the threat of war looming over Iran. That's what they did. Many of them were killed in this Israeli strike. And so you can imagine the regime want to avoid that mistake and avoid getting large numbers of people together in person.
Now, we have had over the last 24 hours Donald Trump making sort of ambiguous comments. There's a story in Axios, the U.S. news source, saying that, you know, he's kind of said to the Iranians, I can pull this off, or, you know, I can stop this in the next 2 or 3 days if you come back to the negotiating table or make concessions in the US and Israel direction. So is it possible amid all this, you know, terrible destruction on the ground in the Middle East that some kind of way back out of it can occur?
I mean, anything is possible with Donald Trump. We really don't know what his ultimate aim here is. You're right that in those comments to Axios, he said maybe this will be over in a couple of days. But earlier in the day, yesterday, he suggested that the aim here was regime change. He said this was going to go on for a while and that when it ended, Iranians should take to the streets and overthrow their government. And those two statements obviously seem incompatible with one another. So we really don't know how far the Americans intend to push this. But I think the question of diplomacy, whether there's a diplomatic solution to this, it also will depend on what happens on the Iranian side. How quickly do they manage to install new leadership there? Are the leaders willing to negotiate under fire? Are they willing to make more extensive concessions than they were in the failed nuclear talks that led up to this war? It's too early to answer those questions. We won't know until this political transition takes place.
There seems to be a lot of concern as well about this is going to be Venezuela 2.0, where, yes, the supreme leader is removed, but the rest of the regime, the rest of the snake, as the Americans would call it at least, remains in place if they can get somebody, you know, in place in the next few days. That, yes, the supreme leader will be gone, but the regime marches on. That must be a real concern among ordinary Iranians looking at events.
It is, and it's not an unreasonable scenario to think that that's what the Americans want. They would be happy to do Venezuela 2.0, as you put it, and if they had a regime that was more amenable to their interests, less antagonistic towards the U.S., I think they would settle for that. I think also many Arab countries would be willing to settle for that. They don't want to see chaos in Iran, and so if there was a strong but more pragmatic figure who could assume control, I think that would have the support of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, other countries in the Gulf. The only people who wouldn't be happy are Iranians themselves. I mean, don't forget, it's been less than 2 months now since we saw mass protests across the country that were brutally put down by Iranian security forces who killed more than 7,000 demonstrators in the span of just a few days. So this is a regime that not only is unloved and unpopular, but has fresh blood on its hands right now. And I think many Iranians would feel betrayed if the endpoint of all of this was simply to change the man at the top to keep that regime intact.
Okay, listen, thank you for joining us. We'll leave you there because I know you're trying to cover this live event. That's Greg Karlstrom, who is the Middle East correspondent with The Economist. I'm also joined by Professor Scott Lukens, who lectures in the area of international politics at UCD. Scott, one of the objectives of Israel was to decapitate the leadership. Ayatollah al-Khamenei is deceased as of yesterday. So in that sense, and I know it's a narrow sense, but they have achieved one of the central objectives of this military activity.
Not yet. The Iranian system, despite the fact you have a supreme leader, is actually quite layered. So you have various institutions. You have clerical institutions. You have the political institutions, in other words, the government. And, of course, you have military institutions, such as the elite Revolutionary Guards. The Israelis actually knocked out several key Iranian leaders in that strike yesterday that included the supreme leader. As Greg Karlstrom mentioned, rather unwisely, they had gathered for a meeting at the Supreme Leader's compound. So the defense minister was killed. The army chief of staff was killed. The head of the Revolutionary Guards was killed. But despite that, the Supreme Leader had reportedly said, look, you know, anticipating these attacks, everyone designate a replacement, and then that replacement designate a replacement, and then that replacement designate a replacement. So they're trying to go three or four layers deep because they suffered extensive losses last June when they had more than 20 military commanders killed. And of course, they were able to fill those positions. Now, how long they can keep filling those positions is a key question, as is the question of, all right, what is the transition in terms of, you know, if you don't have a supreme leader, do you have a council? Do you have one single replacement? I think we'll see that play out in the coming days. But no, I don't think the Israelis are going to think that they have actually rendered the regime powerless just because Ayatollah Khamenei has been killed.
Well, I looked at some of the luminaries who might replace him. They do seem to be at a fork in the road moment, in the sense that they have a choice between some real hardliners that might even be harder than the previous occupant of the office. And then there's more what they call pragmatic or slightly liberalizing leaders. So they've got a big decision to make, if they're even in a position to make it physically, between two different roads out of this conflict.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I also think in a way we're sort of ahead of ourselves here. And that is that, you know, these airstrikes are still ongoing. You know, as you and I speak, Israel is pounding central Tehran. Iran, of course, is retaliating, as you have been reporting, with attempted strikes on Bahrain, on Qatar, and on Oman this morning. You know, and until you actually get, as it were, some type of breathing space from the airstrikes, I don't think you're going to get a clear idea which way the Iranians are going to go. And indeed, the statement, you know, the latest statement, who is from the Supreme Leader's political advisor, Ali Larijani, a very experienced man, is, you know, very defiant. You know, we're going to unleash, you know, fury against those who have attacked us. Now, I'm not sure Iran can do that, but it shows for a moment that as you get thousands who are already mourning the death of the Supreme Leader, that the regime is going to express defiance.
Meanwhile, we have these slightly ambiguous comments from Donald Trump saying, you know, I could call this off over the next two or three days if I want to, etc. So where's Trump at the moment? I mean, he's gone big on this. This is a huge gamble for even for him. But he seems to be at least hinting that he can come back from the edge of the precipice if he so chooses.
I never start with Trump statements. Never do.
Good idea.
I think you look at those around Trump. You know, whether you talk about the Vice President J.D. Vance, the Secretary of State Marco Rubio, even, you know, and those in the Pentagon, the military. And I think the best way to express it to him is actually to get it back on where we know where we were on Thursday with the last set of U.S.-Iran talks. And in those talks, the Americans had a couple of conditions the Iranians will not accept. The Americans are saying, look, you get zero enrichment of uranium. You get no nuclear program. And the Iranians are saying, no, we want a civilian nuclear program. You can't take that away from us. And secondly, the Americans say, you have to put ballistic missiles on the table. You have to discuss limits on your missiles, on the number and on the range. And the Iranians are saying, no, we only want to discuss the nuclear program. Now, by Saturday, all of that changes, because when Israel and the U.S. go in, they clearly are going beyond the terms of the talks, and they're trying to kill the regime. So I think the open question here is whether, and Greg Carlson put it very, very well, whether you get back to the position we were last week, albeit with the Americans having far more leverage to tell the Iranians, we want you to limit the missiles. We want zero nuclear enrichment, not even 3.67% enriched uranium, and whether the Iranians would accept that. I think if the Iranians would accept that, there is the prospect of what you called a Venezuela 2.0, that the regime will not be completely replaced, but that they will, in effect, have bowed down to the U.S. I think if Iran maintains its conditions, then I think this attempt to kill the regime will continue. The big problem here is, and I've got a lot of friends in Iran who have been trying to change the regime, who have been calling for reforms, calling for rights, but there's no organized leadership, because many of those leaders have been detained or killed since the mass protest after the 2009 manipulated elections.
Yeah. Okay, listen, I'm going to have to leave it there for the moment. I'm sure we'll be talking to you again as this story unfolds. Scott Lucas is a professor of U.S. and international politics at UCD. And before that, you heard Greg Carlstrom, who is the Middle East correspondent with The Economist. Now, joining me here in the studio for perspectives on this and a whole load of other stuff as well from the Sunday newspapers is my panel. So let me introduce them. I have Pat Rabbitt, former leader, of course, of the Labour Party, you'll know well. I have Gina London, who's a communications specialist, former CNN correspondent, and with the Sunday Independent, where she writes a column. And I have Jen Cummins, who is a Social Democrats TD. All three of you, all very welcome. Pat, I'm going to go to you first. We're obviously digesting, really, every day seems to be a milestone event in the Trump administration, but that's a separate issue. But nevertheless, it is a big moment in Middle East history for the death of Ayatollah al-Khamenei. We don't know what comes next. He was a very, very bad and brutal leader of that country. But this seems like a fairly significant milestone moment.
It does. And nobody is going to shed many tears for the departure of the beloved leader. But we have no idea what the consequences of this may be for the Middle East. And it seems to me that Netanyahu is calling the shots, just like he called the shots after the horror massacre of October 7th, when he played Trump for a fool. And he's playing him for a fool now again. And of course, there's no consistency in what Trump says. I mean, he announced after the attack on Iran some 9 months ago that he had obliterated their nuclear capacity and nuclear resources. Now he says, or his right-hand man, Wipkoff, says in the Financial Times yesterday that they were within a week of creating a bomb. There's no consistency, no common sense, no significant government in the Western world would send two estate developers around the world negotiating peace. Those two guys, I mean, if I had a development site, I might well send for Wipkoff and Kushner. They would be good to advise me on erecting apartments. But as regards to international diplomacy, it's shocking.
And Pat, what do you think you were saying Israel is calling the shots? So what's their ultimate objective? Is it just dismantle the current regime and the nuclear program, or is there just altering the power balance in the region? What do they ultimately want, in your view?
Well, I think, yes, of course, nuclear non-proliferation would be one major objective. But the other major objective is Netanyahu and his survival. As you know, he's arraigned on bribery charges, and apart from that, he's in deep political trouble. He's in possession of half of the Gaza Strip. He's facing a reckoning before the people. He wanted to continue 9 months ago the advantage they had then against Iran. And at that time, Trump backed out. Now Trump is front and center of the assault. And we don't know if there's a speedy collapse. Well, then perhaps you can get back to the discussions, as Scott Lucas said there a moment ago, where we were last Thursday. Again, the Financial Times estimated, the Atomic Agency told the Irish Times that there probably were nuclear resources enriched to the extent of 60%, but that in order to create a nuclear bomb, you need 90% enrichment, and that there was no immediate prospect of that. And Iran was insisting that they didn't want to produce a bomb. They wanted for civilian purposes.
Hold that thought for the moment as I bring the rest of my panel in. Gina, what's your reaction? We have an amazing front page, the Sunday Times this morning. Ayatollah killed in blitz from America and Israel. One of the most evil men in history is dead, says Trump.
Well,
what's your reaction to what happened?
Yeah, well, my reaction is echoing, I think, what we've already been hearing from Greg Scott and now Pat, is why now? That this imminent threat, as Trump said in his, of course, very 2 a.m.-ish pre-recorded announcement of all of this, is there is no evidence of an imminent threat. And so the picking up on what Emmett just said about political survival for Netanyahu, there's also political survival elements for Donald Trump, too, as the Epstein files will not go away. And this past week, we were just talking about how National Public Radio, which he's tried to dismantle, had uncovered that there were 50-plus pages missing from the Epstein files. The Department of Justice in the United States, supposedly the Transparency Administration of all administrations, had disappeared, that were naming Trump, an accuser who had gone to the FBI, accusing Trump of sex with this woman when she was 13 years old. So there's distraction going on the Epstein files around this devastating illegal war that has been launched by Trump and Netanyahu.
Does it matter a jot that they're going to try and the U.S. politicians are going to try and force a vote in Congress over all this, or is it all horses bolted and all of it irrelevant?
Wednesday's scheduled vote is looking like it's not going to be passed at this point. I mean, Mike Johnson and the Republicans, they thought maybe some of them would peel away and Congress would finally exert its authority in what we used to have three halls of government in the United States, and now only with the Supreme Court recently saying the Tariffs Emergency Act declarations were illegal, we have two, but we certainly don't have three,
because
Congress
one.
Does nothing these days.
Yesterday, Mark Carney of Canada actually said he supported this campaign, which I was very surprised.
Me too, in the sense, and of course, Keir Starmer said that now there are planes from the UK that are also up. So there, I think there is not necessarily a acceptance of the uncertainty around Trump. There isn't an acceptance around the uncertainty of Trump around his economic situations and the way that he deals with his impulses around tariffs and that sort of thing. But right now, no one's going to say that they want the regime of Iran to stay. That is a bad regime. Whether or not now and the attack on it now is the right thing, it's happened. So these other governments like Canada, as you mentioned, are taking a standpoint of, well, if things work out, then okay. But this certainly isn't America first. This certainly isn't no foreign wars. And the question is, we've toppled regimes before, like in Venezuela, just for, as you said, a substitution of essentially the same. When we had toppled in 2003 Saddam Hussein, we certainly didn't get a lot of improvements in Iraq. So what is going to happen? It's one thing say, oh, take over the government. Now's the time. Well, what are you going to do with the Republican Guard? What are you going to do with
Gina,
the situations in place?
Let me just bring in our third contributor, who is Jen Cummins, who's a Social Democrats TD. Jen, what do you make of all of this? I mean, obviously, Irish people looking on from afar, in one sense, they might be relieved that it's not happening in this part of the world, but lots of people have family in the region, lots of people have business links in the region. We're total onlookers at the moment, although we'll come onto those issues, other issues around security and military spending in a while. But what's your reaction to what happened over the last 24 hours?
Yeah, my reaction, I think the thing that stuck out for me the most actually was the school children killed, the 108 to date to this time that have been found. And you know, here we have a repeat of what's happening elsewhere in the world by similar leaders, the same leaders feeling that it's totally acceptable to bomb schools. So this is an attack that is totally not allowed under international law. Obviously, it's the month of Ramadan. So for those people, the holy time of Ramadan. So for those people who are fasting and participating in Ramadan, this is really an awful time for this to happen to them. It's the most sacred time for Muslims. And I suppose, as you say, we're looking on from afar, but there are 12,000 Irish citizens who are living in places like Dubai. And I'd say many, many teachers, and as education spokesperson, you know, we know the recruitment shortage of teachers in this country because they're having a wonderful life in Dubai. I would say the fear at the moment for those Irish teachers in particular and anybody else working in that area is absolutely horrific. And there's no flights in and out. And I would say that's very, very difficult. And for the families who are here thinking of their loved ones who are living there, we might be looking on, you know, from afar, but it certainly impacts Ireland for the amount of people who are living there.
Yeah, and there's so many different elements to the news. We won't get to a lot of them this morning because there's just sheer volume here that we have to deal with. Mm. Stuff about, you know, tourism. Of course, we have the oil market opening up on Monday. That's going to be interesting, if not quite alarming. What's going to happen? Prices were just nudging up, Gina, before we went into all of this. So it'll be interesting to see. The Straits of Hormuz moves about 25% of the global oil supply goes through there, which seems to be very slow moving. Anyway, we'll take a short break and we'll come back with our panel after this. Now, let me introduce my newspaper panel, who have a pretty arduous, tough task to get through all the stuff that's going on internationally and domestically. I'm Pat Rabbit, the former leader of the Labour Party. I've Gina London, who is a communications specialist and former CNN correspondent. And I've Jen Cummins, who is a Social Democrats TD. Right, folks, we're going to kind of move out of war and security, but not really. We're going to talk a little bit more about it in a domestic context. Pat, very fascinating story on the front of the Sunday Times. Ireland will be on a war footing during the EU presidency, says John Mooney, who's their investigations editor. And this article, certainly from what I can see, he's effectively gone and taken the experience of Denmark, which held the presidency quite recently, and they suffered attacks, hybrid attacks, quite bad hacking of some other infrastructure, even railways. So it's not a massive leap to say that's the kind of threats we would be facing in a few months' time. Or is it a massive leap?
Well, I think, you know, it's obviously necessary for us to do everything that we affordably can do to protect our critical infrastructure. That's my basic position. After that, I'm somewhat sceptical of the extraordinary campaign that's underway to tell us that the Russians are coming or someone are coming for us. I mean, I don't know.
What do you mean? And I don't like. I don't know if Russian ships are going through near our coastal.
Yeah,
like, that's not made up. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the incident off Hoth about the drones at the time of Zelensky. I don't know whether that happened or not. We have never been told if it did happen, who was behind it. And having made the point I made about the necessity to protect critical infrastructure, of course we must. But it's about time that we intruded a quiet note of debate in terms of, for example, the economic dimension. The budget for defence in the last budget was $1.5 billion. Roughly a quarter percent of national income. If you were to bring that, never mind Trump and 5%, if you were to bring that to 2%, that's 8 times $1.5 billion every year. That's $12 billion every year. So, I mean, I think we need to have a rational discussion. The Irish, successive Irish governments and the Irish public service have always done a splendid job. I was there twice to manage the EU presidency. Our performance is second to none, and I believe it will be second to none again.
Okay.
And I have no objection to cooperating with
France. But if you're planning for an EU presidency, presumably you start from the vantage point of what's the worst that could happen, and you need to be forewarned and forearmed for the worst. If it doesn't happen, fine. You can't, I suppose, sit there and say, well, hopefully these hybrid attacks won't happen. You've got to plan for the worst. Would you agree?
Yeah. Well, that's prudent that you take all reasonable steps. But, I mean, I think we can't let reason go out the window. I mean, I see commentary today about will Helen McEntee keep us safe. I'm fairly confident that Helen McEntee will keep us safe.
Okay.
And I think the debate should be ratcheted down. The Irish people will react negatively if we continue this high-pressure campaign. The Russians are coming, or the Chinese.
Well, I don't think this particular story is a campaign. All he's simply done is.
No, I'm not referring to John Mooney.
Oh, well, that's what I'm talking. Yeah, okay.
No, I'm not. I'm talking about the campaign that's out there almost every day now.
Yeah, well,
I'm as much afraid of Trump as I am of a lot of the other.
Gina,
dictators.
You want to come in on this?
Well, I was only going to say, as Pat was talking about being afraid of Trump, and I think that puts us into the context of taking over the presidency of the EU Council in July, why it's important to consider what the EU role is in terms of its solidarity and its position as that trusted Western cohesive entity within the world right now that there isn't with the Trump factor. And so that does put more pressure on the presidency and the EU Council than ever before. And it certainly isn't that the Russians are coming or the Chinese are coming, but cyber attacks in particular, nobody has to come.
We had a HSE attack
exactly.
A few years ago, which was
so
pretty disgusting.
Where the ratcheting up of budgets for security, the concerns of cost, yes, but more it's the allocation, the prioritization of what the money goes to. And I think the concern is real, as indicated by that Ireland Think poll that said 63% of people that were surveyed are concerned that there isn't enough security. What that doesn't mean tanks on the ground, but it means professionals who can defend us against the security of a cyber attack that could be very concerning.
There's only one of you three who is in our parliament, who's a parliamentarian, has an ex-parliamentarian. But are we ready? Because the poll this morning is pretty unambiguous. Almost 70% says we are not ready for this EU presidency and all that surrounds it.
Yeah, I think we do need to be calm, though. I think today's news, the newspapers are full of war happening all over the world. And we need to take stock of where actually we are. And we need to have less people with opinions and more people with facts. And I know that we have 8 vessels and 4 of them are working. I know that the calls constantly are for more investment into defence, for recruitment, for resourcing our defence force personnel, for looking at how are we going to resource technologies and systems that do in terms of cyber defence. We also need to
let's also look what happened with Denmark, right? Which involved waves of military grade drone activity over their airports and military sites, forcing temporary airspace closures over an extended period. That's a fact.
Yeah, and we need to be ready for that. If that's going to happen, we need to be ready for that. And if we are not, like, we can't, I think that we're kind of often, like, with regards to neutrality, obviously the vast majority of people want to maintain neutrality, but that doesn't mean that we can't defend ourselves. That's really, really important. And that nuance, I think, sometimes gets lost as, well, we were neutral, so no one will attack us. Listen, look what happened this morning. Did anybody in Iran or did anyone in Dubai think that they were going to be bombed this morning? No, they didn't. So we need to be prepared. I'm not saying we need to have nuclear weapons and all that sort of stuff, but we do need to be able to patrol our waters.
Do we need to have a defence minister as opposed to a foreign affairs minister holding the defence portfolio? That's what the Mail are saying to me.
I think Helen McEntee is very clear in her portfolios. Certainly when she was education, she was very clear in her role there. And I have no doubt that she'll be very clear in her role as foreign affairs. And it does take into defence. Perhaps there needs to be a separation of defence and security, Pat, from foreign affairs. Okay. But
Pat, does it matter the allocation of the ministerial portfolios that she's doing that joint role? If you're saying the spending is going to increase one way or the other, so do we need to hive out defence on its own? Or does that make much difference in your mind?
Well, it probably does make some difference in so much as perhaps too frequently in the last five decades, defence has been an add-on to a major ministry. It probably does matter. Somebody who's preoccupied with the foreign affairs portfolio, obviously won't have as much time to focus as if there was a minister focused on defence only. And, we're coming to the debate late and we seem to be railroaded now into dramatic statements because of the proximity of the EU presidency. And yes, of course, we have to take steps now in the new geopolitical environment that would be unheard of the last time that I was president of a Council.
I read something really interesting, and Ollie, you come chip in this the other day, that Irish military doctrine, the official sort of what are we trying to do here, is we're trying to build up our military to such an extent that we can withstand an attack until allies come to our aid. That's the official. I didn't know this. It was in that maritime strategy that was released during the week. Now, how do we feel about that idea that we want to build the military up to a level that we could sort of, you know, have a hard shell for a period before the allies? And who are the allies? Are they the EU? Is it Britain? Is it France? Is it the United States of America? So what do you think? That's the official doctrine of the military, the Irish Defence Force.
I think the cyber threat is really the threat that we have to try and cope with. I don't particularly expect that anybody is going to attack us. And if somebody is going to attack us, I'm not so sure how long we would be able to hold out. But what we can do in the interim is take reasonable steps to ensure that in terms of the modern style of using cyber weaponry against us, that we can do as well as we might to defend ourselves.
So you see the electronic domain arena as the bigger threat.
That's the one that would concern me. I mean, I think the talking about war footing and all the rest is... if the Irish people get the impression that we're trying to sell them a pup. Because remember, the corporate tax situation has changed everything. But I remember the time when Albert Reynolds came back from Brussels.
Oh, yeah, he got his deal.
$7 billion. And this was supposed to keep us going for 30 years. Now, to invest in this area is more than $7 billion every year. Yeah, okay. Every year.
Let's leave defence for the moment, of a different type of defence. We're getting warnings as Patrick's Day comes in, Gina, that, and this is a terrible thing to say, but there could be violence of a different type down in Temple Bar. There has been a number of very nasty attacks down there in recent weeks. Tourists in particular told to watch out. Is that just prudent advice at this time of the year, unfortunately?
Of course it's prudent advice. I mean, the timing of the scramblers being made illegal is also part of the trying to keep that disorderly behavior, trying to get people to be more celebratory and less inflammatory, especially during holidays that surround themselves around intake of a particular beverage. And so, yeah, the article that comes out that talks about the concerns around Temple Bar and how are we going to be able to increase the police forces and make sure that the security is there while people are hopefully having a safe celebratory time is something of concern. It's growing more and more. I mean, the disruptions in the city center have been alarming over the past year and a half, 2 years. And so now when you bring in all of this and the volatility that comes around alcohol and that type of behavior, it does make it to be concerned. So back to defense preparations, yes, the preparation is important, of course.
Okay, listen, this is the part of the conversation Jen was most looking forward to me discussing, which is the Ireland Thinks poll, which has the Social Democrats on 11%.
Yep.
The party you all broke away from back on 4%, which Pat once upon a time led. So why
I might clarify, I never broke away because I was never part
no,
of it.
No, not you personally, but a number of your prominent members did. So what are you guys apparently doing right and what are Labour and other smaller parties doing wrong in your view?
Well, I'll speak for ourselves. I think we have a very talented parliamentary party and I think we have very, very hardworking councillors on the ground. I think our message is very clear. I think our messaging is very clear and it's accessible to people.
And how are you different from Labour? Like what I mean is what are
well,
you saying that's different?
I can tell you how Labour is. Do you know what I mean? I think that there's
a lot
of...
I'm just trying to gauge why you're at 11 and the others are not. Like what's the differentiator? Is it Holly Cairns' style?
Are we very cool?
What is it?
Are we very cool? Or I think, do you know what? I think we have, if you look at, I'm education spokesperson. You know, I've come from an education background. I know my area inside out. I have a lot of connections with people. So that when I'm able to contact people and have those conversations and know what's happening on the ground and be able to bring that up in the Dáil, or, you know, I think that's really important. Having people working in a spokespersonship role is new, that they actually know what they're talking about, that they come from that area. And we have that across our parliament. Party. And I think that is really, really, it's possibly unusual in politics that you have people who
now you've had a few knockbacks. You've had the Gary Gannon, Alan Shatter thing, and before that you had the thing with the Israeli shares and all that. So you seem to
no party is perfect. We don't have the answers to absolutely everything. We're all human. We all make mistakes, and we will continue. I'm sure there'll be mistakes in the future. I hope I don't make too many of them. But I think that people certainly, when we're canvassing, we
you mainly attribute it to the depth of knowledge that you're very
depth of knowledge,
hardworking,
and we're very clear with our messaging. And I think that's seen on the doors when we're in the by-elections.
Pat, can I ask you? You have a real deep insight into this. You led the Labour Party for many years. They're back, as I would say. I usually see the word languishing at 4%. Jen's party are at 11%. That's a big gap. What do you ascribe that to? Or is it just the bumps of polls and next week it'll be something different?
No, I'd say it's more than just the bumps of polls. I mean, the poll this morning, the thing that jumps out at you is the strong performance of the Social Democrats. The rest is all pretty predictable and it's pretty same and it's pretty the same as it's been since the election. There really isn't much difference other than, of course, the extraordinary fragmentation that has happened since the
financial... So why do you think they're on 11, the SOC Dems?
Since the financial collapse, there's been a general fragmentation.
What would you isolate as the reasons for, from what you can see?
I'm not sure. There has always been a small social democratic cohort in Irish politics. The standard bearer for that for 100 years was the Labour Party. It would appear the Labour Party is no longer the sexy option, that the more novel option and more attractive option.
But what is it?
Young people? Yeah. I don't know. I mean...
Should they be worried?
I'm quite sure that everything that Jen has said about her own knowledge of her portfolio is true. But to be honest, there are lots of people in different parties in Dáil Éireann who have people who are on top of their portfolio. That alone does not do it for me. How do you explain the by-election in Manchester where in a first-past-the-post system, a system divined for two parties, now has at least four parties contesting.
So you're talking about general change.
There's general change that is evident and apparent.
Ireland, okay, listen, let's take a short break and come back with property. Let's move on to other matters in the Sunday papers here in Ireland. Property, again, consuming huge amounts of column inches. Let me introduce our panel. Pat Rabbit is the former leader of the Labour Party. Gina London is a communications specialist. She's writing in the Sunday Independent these days and used to be with CNN. And Jen Cummins is a Social Democrats TD. Folks, you're all very welcome. Jen, if I can start with you, property, we have an interesting story on the front of the Sunday Independent that some people are managing to put a deposit and the purchase price of a house together, and they're mainly women.
It's great. I mean, it's fantastic that anyone can afford to buy a house, considering the prices of houses. My clinic, I have clinics every week, almost every week, and it's inundated with housing situations, whether that's somebody trying to find somewhere to rent or somewhere to buy. People are saying to me that they're getting, I'm aware of a situation where there's a five in a row and the bottom in the row of, buying houses all the way along, the bottom had a difficulty with something. And now the top has something, a difficulty, kind of different issues. So the people in the middle are all stuck in this line to buy houses, and it's taking months and months and months. I mean, I think that, the price of houses, I live in Dublin 8, the price of houses is just, it's eye-watering. So that anyone who can afford a house is fantastic. I'm delighted to see that it's women
it
who are able to afford.
It seems to suggest, this is an article Wayne O'Connor has, it seems to suggest that women are in higher professional roles. I'm just reading out what he says here. He says they're earning good money in multinationals and other sectors and want to buy instead of paying rent.
Yeah.
And we don't see this trend of women buying more than men. This is like, first-time buyers changing anytime soon. Gina?
Yeah. Well, I liked this article because it was interesting that it was talking about how, yes, the women are older, so they're likely earning more, and that the median cost is around $650,000, which is no small matter for your first home. And then the line that I thought was fun, to your point, Emmett, was he's talking about how single men, apparently, they need to be in a couple with a woman to actually motivate them to ultimately buy. So they're not as high. But the facts and the figures are still really right around that half point margin. So about apparently a year ago, 55% of the buyers were women. And the year before that, it was less at 53%. But again, I can say as one of those women in that older demographic, I still rent.
You can say that I can.
I still rent, folks.
Okay.
So it's
you're not in
easy,
these figures. You are
not an easy one.
Pat, one of the interesting developments as well, we still have a very dysfunctional housing market. You can go on the prices on that, and as a percentage of the average salary people is earning will tell you that. But a solution may be arriving over the hill. We had this idea of a housing czar. We didn't really get one. But now we're told the Department of Health boss, the Secretary General there, Robert Watt, who's, as described in the piece, a veteran civil servant, may be the man, apparently, that will take on this role. And I can see he knows the system well. But on the flip side of that, people might say, if there's anyone coming from the system, it would be him. So would his appointment be a little lack of an outsider perspective that might be needed to shake this area up?
Yeah, I don't know. I met him accidentally the week before last, and we were talking about him leaving health. He gave no indication of any movement within the service. I don't know. I can't comment on that. I mean, the notion of the housing czar, as I understand it, was to iron out wrinkles in the system, and the government, having put the post out there, couldn't manage to fill it, make an appointment because of internal wrangling. And I thought it was even more extraordinary when the Secretary General of the Department of Housing came out and said there was no necessity for a housing czar. Well, maybe he's right, but the question arises, if there are wrinkles to be ironed out, why hasn't he and his senior colleagues ironed them out in the last decade?
But would you concede that Robert Watt, I'm sure he has lots of very positive attributes or he wouldn't be in the role he has, but he has a checkered track record?
Well, I mean, he's very outspoken and combative. I don't know why that ought to be,
And his involvement in the Tony Holohan affair, he didn't come out of that, in my view, if you read the report, that well.
I think that's right on that particular one. But I think if you look at the job that Bernard Gloucester and himself has done in health, there really have been very significant improvements in health.
But they're breaking still through their budget year after year after year massively.
Yes, and you probably noticed that Bernard Gloucester made that an issue on his appointment when he made plain that he wasn't going to be able to survive within the envelope then provided, and probably only moving to a multi-annual budgeting system for health is going to make the necessary.
And it sounds like you're not against the idea of what doing this. You can see some attributes to it being positive.
Well, I mean, you have to. I mean, the story about women buying homes, I mean, it seems to me the issue is affordable homes, whether you're male or female. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem we have. And if it is believed by the experts who look at it every day that there are wrinkles that might be sorted out, well, then I'm all for it. But I mean, it seems to me that one of the really major issues is land. And provided you can sequester enough land in the right place with planning permission, then you go to the market for builders to build.
Okay.
Now, the Land Development Agency, to some degree, and having taken quite a while to ramp up, is beginning to do that.
Okay.
But by God, it's awful slow.
Apparently, 8,000 workers needed to build the metro are going to be housed in prefabs, which is going to be where they put the prefabs. They may be not full housing, but they still need space. That's probably a story we'll come back to on another day. I'm going to finish up because we have only a few minutes left. But apparently, Gina, we're all becoming skinnier. We can get our suits remade with Louis Copeland. And it's all down to weight loss drugs that are apparently slimming out our waistlines. And there's nothing but good news in this area.
Well,
apparently.
This is a lovely profile piece. And having met Louis Copeland a number of times, I can say he certainly is one of the quintessential statesmen when it comes to sartorial menswear. And his take is, men are wanting to redo their wardrobes because they've lost weight on Ozempic or pick your GLP-1 drug, and they're feeling better and feeling more invigorated. So this
I'm not feeling any
is,
of those things, but yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, who are these men?
You need to get the jab, apparently.
I need to get the jab, right? But how are you feeling?
Yeah, he Louis is a bit of the Michael O'Leary of the retail world. He's very good at promoting his company. And I suppose it follows that if Ozempic is becoming as plentiful as we're told it is, that it would be good for his business. It's quite expensive. It's quite an exclusive male or female access to it. You need to be able to pay, as I understand it, unless you have particular health conditions. I think you have to pony up. But if it's good for Louis and it's good for jobs, I'm all behind it.
It's good for sustainability. I love the resizing of a suit. If you have a good suit and it fits really well, and then you lose weight for whatever reason and you get it sized down, fantastic.
That's good. It's good for the planet as well, apparently. Yeah. So listen, thank you very much. Pat Rabbins, a former leader of the Labour Party. Gina London is a communications specialist and she's with the Sunday Independent. And Jen Cummins is with the Social Democrats, where she's a TD.
News Talk Sunday.